Tēnā koutou katoa. Welcome everybody. I'm Jo Blakely. It's my very great pleasure to introduce to you Stephen Downs, our keynote speaker, who's come all the way from Maple Country. He's been on the road for quite a few days now, and we really appreciate him taking the time to come across the ditch to New Zealand and talk to us. He's from New Brunswick and East Coast of Canada. That's where he's been recently. We've got a few things in common, actually, Stephen and I. He probably doesn't realise, but we probably went to university about the same time. We're about the same kind of vintage, Stephen. And while I might have done my horticultural science degree and Stephen's done his degree in philosophy, probably something much more useful, he's been able to create or work in jobs now that when I was a university student, they've never been invented. I don't know if you know about learning architects or information architects, instructional and new media designer. You know, when I was at university and the computer was about the size of this room and we were still using punch cards, the whole concept of a new media designer just wasn't even there. So I think it's just fascinating to see that learning has moved along, and we have the privilege to hear Stephen talk to us today about how much he's moved learning along and his perception on the online world. So thank you, Stephen.
Well, thank you. I skipped the coffee too. On behalf of the government and the people of Canada, I'd like to bring you my greetings. It's a genuine pleasure to be here in New Zealand. And I've travelled all the way from Stewart Island up to Northland, Whangarei, and this is an astonishingly beautiful country. Now I come from Canada. I don't say stuff like that lightly, because we're pretty proud of our beauty in Canada. But this is a place that is relentlessly beautiful. And I took the bus from Auckland to Wellington a couple of days ago, and people sort of looked at me like I was nuts. But I like New Zealand has a desert. I never knew that. And I just sort of I jumped to the tour and took the bus and discovered a desert, and that's sort of like a metaphor for life or something. And the people here, I've told other people this, the people here in New Zealand are just lovely, lovely people. Have been unremittingly kind and generous, and they all say, or most of them, I guess, I don't know about all of them, but they say, "Hiya." And for those of you know who read my email, I always begin my email with "Hiya." And I've never actually heard people say that. And it was so neat, I'm there and I walk into a cafe and the woman behind the counter, she goes, "Hiya," and I'm like, "Oh, I'm home." As the introduction said, I have been on the road a long time. I started in Frankfurt after an overnight flight from Toronto, after a flight from Moncton, and I was there for their Saturday morning market, and I was eating bratwurst, and then I found myself in South Africa, and I went to Lesotho, which is that little round country completely enclosed by South Africa, and I saw what they call cattle boys. And what cattle boys are, they're people who tend to their herd of cattle, and the herd of cattle is 12, 15 cows, and they sit on their horse. They always have a horse or a mule, and they have a stick, and they wear their blanket, and they wear their hat. They used to wear their traditional Basotho hats, but now most often they wear something sort of like toques. These are, like blankets and toques. It's Africa. And they always have one dog or two dogs, and that's what they do, is they tend their cattle. And I was talking to people there about, because they start this life when they're 5 years old, 6 years old, and they go into the mountains, and they're on their own, and they're tending their cattle, and you know, and they feed themselves and they clothe themselves and all of that. And you know, the government and other agencies try to offer them schooling, but the schooling would bring them down from the mountain, and they don't want to come down from the mountain. And you know, having seen their mountains, I don't blame them. I wouldn't want to come down from that mountain either. I wouldn't want to leave my horse or my mule and my dogs, especially not my dogs. I wouldn't want to go to a school and have to not wear my blanket anymore, or my hat, or whatever. And it's just, so I'm sort of thinking, how do you educate, how do you provide an education, and what do you do to that sort of society when you're offering that education? What does that change? And I was in Johannesburg, which is where I lost my passport and my airline tickets. And I'm told Johannesburg isn't the place to do that. And I went to Kruger National Park. This was while I still didn't have a passport and airline tickets. I figured, well, I'll go on safari if I can't go overseas. And I saw zebras and no lions. I didn't see lions. Or more accurately, they didn't see me. And I saw Cape Town, and I was briefly in Australia, and then of course here from Stewart Island, Christchurch, Dunedin, Auckland, Whangarei. So I'm overwhelmed, and I'll admit that I'm standing here before you right now overwhelmed. Overwhelmed with sensory experience, overwhelmed with cross-cultural experience. I was thinking just as I was skipping the coffee queue that I was having information overload, and other people, information overload is 1,500 emails. I deal with that, you know, pretty much every day. For me, information overload was like real life. And the irony struck me. So, what this talk is it kind of comes out of that. A long time ago, I was asked to write an outline, and you know, I really didn't know what I was going to talk about because I knew I was going to go through all of this. And so, but this talk is some of the reflections that come out of all of that, and those reflections as applied to the sorts of things that I have to say about learning technology, learning networks, e-learning 2.0, and all of that stuff. And what this trip has done is probably done lots of things to me, which I won't discover until much later, but what this trip has done to me is had me see my own thinking in a different way, from a different perspective, and that's always a good thing. Now, they tell me this mouse works just by clicking it. Yeah. So, here's the setup. The setup, all my slides are awful, by the way, I'm sorry. Think of them mostly as speaking notes that you get to see, too. Oh, and while I'm speaking, there are some of you on computers, and many of you have cell phones and things like that. Please continue to use them. If you're online or whatever, do feel free to send messages back and forth. Feel free to send messages to me. I won't get them until the end of the year. I have actually taken messages while giving a talk. So, had I been planning better ahead of time, we'd have the messages up here on this screen. So, yeah, I do want you to feel connected, particularly if I hit a slow patch in the talk. It's been known to happen. 2006 has seen the emergence of the personalized web, the interactive web, web 2.0, or as I'm given credit sometimes now, as e-learning 2.0. And the question that faces us typically is, how should the learning sector, how should we respond? And the short version of that is very badly so far. I've been struck by the oddity because I've gone from place to place, college to college, school to school, and I find that most of the technologies that I'm talking about and I want to demonstrate and show people are blocked. I find that a very odd sort of thing. And now, after all of this, I'm thinking of it as walls. It's just walls all around me. I want to Skype someone. There's a wall. I want to do a blog post. There's a wall. Mostly, schools, colleges, universities have been reacting to these new technologies by blocking them. And I know there's good reasons for that, and I know there's security and all of that, but, you know, I mean, security is like walls. I mean, the best of walls around your house isn't going to keep people out. You know, the best security system isn't going to block people. I'm reminded of the Microsoft Darknet paper, a very famous paper written by some Microsoft technicians, and they're writing about digital rights management, and their conclusion essentially is no digital rights management system will succeed. Any way of locking down content will inevitably be broken, and Microsoft should know. You know, they come out with a security system. 3 days later, the crack comes out for it. I mean, I read just this morning that Microsoft is suing the people who wrote software, I think, what was it, a free WMV or something like that. It's a software that cracks the security encryption on the Windows media format. You can't build a society with walls. I'm at, where was it, one of the technical universities, and they're going to have Wi-Fi, they're going to have internet access and all of that, and of course, like all the other universities, they're locked down. You have to give your name, your address, your MAC address, your blood type, your mother's maiden name, and then maybe, just maybe, they'll let you have it if, and anyhow, that system was hacked, and it was down while we were there. The longer term, we have to do something more imaginative than blocking this technology. We need to live and teach and learn where the students live and teach and learn. That means that we have to stop blocking to their spaces and go to their spaces. So we explore their world. But, you know, there's the age-old danger of explorers that when we go to their world, we're going to want to colonize it. And we're going to want to make them like us. And we're going to want to take them from their mountains and put them in rooms and put walls around them and put locks on their doors and say, this is civilization. And that appears wrong to me. And it appears wrong to me not just because I was recently in Africa. It has always appeared wrong to me. I mean, again, I'm from Canada. I'm at home, most at home, when I'm in a forest and there's nothing around me. There's no walls, there's no barriers. Maybe there's a river, but whatever. And so it just does seem wrong to me. Now, how is this playing out? Dana Boyd wrote a brilliant paper on MySpace, Identity Production in a Networked Culture, Why Youth Hurt MySpace. And basically what she says in her analysis of MySpace, and in the group, the workshop yesterday, we actually went to MySpace and looked around at the sites, and what she says is MySpace is identity production playing itself out visibly. People creating and demonstrating their own identity in this online world. And I commented yesterday, 86 million people, they can do anything they want, they can express themselves, and they come up with that. But that's MySpace. We heard, especially in our traveling group here in New Zealand, we heard a lot about Second Life. And the Second Life, to me, is almost an old story. And it's almost an old story because I actually came onto the internet sometime in the late 1980s as a participant or a player in what was called a multi-user dungeon, or MUD. And I, in particular, played on a MUD called Mud Dog MUD. Virtual reality at its best. Based at the University of Florida. I can still remember the title screen in my head. And my online character was Labatt the Cat. And I was a wizard. Actually, I was a senior wizard. I was very proud. I was more proud of that than my BA. And Sherry Turkle, again, examines the world of MUDs. And MUDs are like Second Life, except without the graphics. Funny how you describe things, how that changes over time. And again, and I saw this for myself, people playing in these muds are creating their own identity. They're trying on different hats. They're trying on different ways to live, different ways to interact. And that's okay. And we don't say, well, this is, well, I mean, we do say, but how do I want to say that? I was going to say, we don't say that this is good or this is bad, but of course we do say that this is good and this is bad. But, and then I wanted to say, well, we don't mean it, but of course we do mean it. But mostly what I want to say is this kind of diversity, including of opinion, is expected. A mud is one of these wild, free-ranging places, and that's also true of Second Life, except with graphics. All of this, you know, my background in MUDs and, you know, creating and recreating my own identity online, and I'm sure many of you have seen my own identity online in my web page and my other web page and the secret hidden web page that nobody's allowed to see, a very popular one. And all of that, and my background, and then coming through and with the traveling group and all of that, put me in a position where I'm looking at the contrast, is the word I'll use right now, between groups and networks. And I posted in my website a few days ago this post here: groups require unity, networks require diversity. Groups require coherence, networks require autonomy, and so on. And to put that into context right now, now, historically, and those of you who've taken political science, or those of you who have heard of it, know that the all of human history and political science is the division between the individual and the state, right? The person and the group, right? And these are the two divides, and the whole purpose of politics is to find some sort of accommodation for them, or if you're Ayn Rand, to favor the individual and ignore the group. And it seems to me that networks offers that middle way. Networks offers that path that isn't the individual and isn't the group. Doesn't force you to choose between the individual and the group. And it's sort of, I say that because as soon as I came up with this groups versus networks, people are looking at that and saying, well, what's the middle way for that? And no, wait a sec, that is the middle way. So, and I drew this. Let's see if we have internet. Oh, let's see if we have a mouse pointer. There we go. Do I have internet? Okay. So, I drew this. Where did I draw this? In Auckland? It's all blurs, I'm sorry. Because I was talking like this and I wanted to draw out what I meant by that distinction between the group and the network. Okay, well, it's not going to come. And now it's frozen. This must be Microsoft. I'm sorry. I know you have a speaker from Microsoft tomorrow, but when she speaks, tell her or ask her, why? Okay. La-dee-da-dee-da. No, that doesn't work. Right. Okay, we should be okay. Oh, no, I've really messed it up. See, at this point, usually that's just the time where I take the battery out. And interestingly, my screen here is still blank. It's on your computer. That's useful. Oh, there we go. Yeah. Well, okay, and I don't want that anymore. So let's see if we can't go back to the show here. Okay. Because The rest of the talk is basically about this diagram. This diagram is available on my website. Now, if I was doing this diagram today instead of 3 or 4 days ago, it would be a bit different, but not a lot different because not a lot of time has passed. All right, I have a mouse. Let me, and these are not definitions, okay? I don't do definitions. So I don't want somebody coming along like 5 years from now and say, Stephen Dove defines a network. I'm just trying to give you some words to give you kind of a mental picture of what I think this is. And I won't be bound by these words. But more or less, a group is a collection of entities or members according to their nature or their features or their properties or whatever. Essential nature, maybe. Accidental nature, maybe, whatever. But according to their nature. What defines a group is the quality the members possess in common, and then the number of members in that group. Groups are about nature, they're about quality, they're about mass, they're about number. A network, by contrast, is an association, I use that word very precisely, an association of entities or members where this association is facilitated or created by a set of connections between those entities. And if you say, well, what is a connection? A connection is merely some conduit along which a signal can run. And that clarified it, didn't it? What defines a network is the nature and the extent of this connectivity. The nature and the extent to which these individuals are connected together. Now, that may be perfectly fuzzy, but this is the overall view. A group, and this, you know, again, talking to some of the people in this group, and just this whole thing, just sort of, like, once this came together, all the nickels started dropping. A nickel is a 5-cent piece in Canada, and nobody drops them, but it's an expression. And I don't know why I use it. No, I do know why I use it. It was some movie somewhere. You know, I didn't tell him, the nickels just started dropping. It's from a show or something. A group, in other words, is like a school of thought, or a school of fish, or a class of entity, a class of animals, a class and a genus and a species, a class act is kind of a group. Or to flip that around, classes and schools, properly so called, the things that we all grew up in, are groups. Because groups are classes in schools. And indeed, once that line of reading, and I started looking at dictionary definitions, and I started doing Google image searches on the word school, odd that I'd never done that before. And I'm asking, can we even think of schools? Can we even think of classes without at the same time thinking about the attributes of groups? Can we separate in our head those two concepts? Or have they become irrevocably fused in our minds? The discussion I've had since I've come up with this points more toward irrevocably fused, but I hope to shake that a little bit. So let's come back to the challenge, only rephrased, with the attribution in Finnish for Dimmu, because I wanted to include some Finnish in this presentation. Education and authentic learning, he writes, like freedom, is wrapped up with the notion of responsibility and accountability. We need to learn in groups, because that's where we form our identities, true or false. Not in some vast, chaotic network where there's no responsibility, no authenticity. Fascinating how responsibility, authenticity, all these things are joined together. That last little bit harkens to Hubert Dreyfus, who is basically, I don't want to say anti-internet, because that would radically oversimplify his position. But Dreyfus says basically there is no genuine effect, no genuine cause and effect, no genuine consequence to your actions on the internet. Now, I grew up on MUDs. I know how false this is. And the interactions that take place on the internet, contra Dreyfus, are real. And as I said in the group yesterday, I read this summer, I forget where, real is defined as the effect continues to linger after you've turned off the computer.
If that happens, it was real.
A group is elemental. Remember, a group is defined according to its class and the number. And if you want to draw a mental picture, draw a mental picture of one of those ingots or rods of pure gold or something like that. And the idea here is that all of the elements in that ingot are the same. They're all gold atoms, right? And they're just all lined up together. And what makes it more or less valuable is how many of those atoms there are and how pure that ingot of metal is. Interestingly, democracy is a group group phenomenon. Democracy is a bunch of people who are relevantly the same. They all voted Tory, say. And what matters is how many of them there were. So, you know, so many people vote Tory, so many people vote Liberal, and those two sets, those two groups, that's how the government is defined, according to how people voted. Networks is different from that. And a network is, and other people have said this, I'm certainly not the first person to say this, a network is like an ecosystem where there is no requirements that all the entities be the same, where the nature of the entities isn't specifically relevant, where the number of entities isn't specifically relevant. I once got a 20 out of 10, I was so proud, on a project. It was like a bottle of water from the stream, and it was tightly sealed, and I called it Closed Ecosystem Project. And I reported on the slow death and decay of everything inside that bottle. So we hearken back to what Stanley said, right? You know, we have a group or we don't, and without the group there's no responsibility, there's no order, there's nothing but chaos, madness, anarchy. And the question is, forward. That's funny. Sorry. I have this mouse here, right? And forward is on the left, and backward is on the right. Shouldn't that be the other way around? But now the writing's upside down. It's interesting. I'm easily distracted, even when I'm giving a talk. Can we have order, responsibility, identity, all of that good stuff inside an ecosystem? Is the choice before us really order or anarchy? And I argue, no, that isn't the choice. I argue that not only can you have all of those good things inside an ecosystem, inside a network, that in many ways they are relevantly better. Of course, the better stuff was going to come along sooner or later. And you know, it's funny how this I got the aside here. Solon was a Greek archon and is known, to say this briefly, known for bringing the concept of universal laws to Athens. If you think about how law is managed in ancient societies, right? Two people come before the king, and they each plead their case, and the king sort of goes, you win. And the problem is, right, society's right, you know, you do that enough times, and then the king says, you're in my family, you win. And so that sort of problem was happening in Athens, where justice was blatantly unfair. And so what Solon did is he brought a system of laws that would apply to everybody. And so he brings the concept of universal law that applies equally and the same to everybody in Athens. And it's funny how that has survived as an essential and elemental concept in learning today. I've commented, and not purely in jest, when talking about assessment. I want to change the system of assessment in schools. Because right now we have tests and things like that that are scrupulously fair. Particularly in distance learning, where you know we outline the objectives and the performance metrics and the outcomes and all of that. I want to scrap that system. I want testing to be done by at random, by comments from your peers and other people and strangers based on no criteria whatsoever and applied unequally and unfairly. And people say, well, why would you want that? And I'd say, well, that's the way the world works. But the point of that remark is to try to pull apart this idea of universality, everything being the same, and learning. Do we need, as this suggests, do we need the iron hand of justice in our classrooms? Groups. Groups are defined by their unity. In fact, one of the first things you do in a group is you try to maintain its unity. A group needs to be, in some sense, cohesive, united. E pluribus unum, or unum. I don't know how the Latins pronounce it. I don't even know how the Americans pronounce it. Or, to keep this politically fair, the people united will never be defeated. The melting pot, the encouragement to be the same, the encouragement to have the same values, to follow the same vision, to be in some relevant way like the others, because that's what a group is. Without that sameness, you don't have the group. You have energy. And we have technologies specifically designed for the group. Pre-internet technologies appeal to the mass, and you're familiar with these. Mass broadcasts of television, of radio, newspapers, books. These are things that create the identity of the group, and therefore, because the nature of the individual is the same as the nature of the group, it creates the identity of the group. Think about, in your own country, have there been these moments that have defined the country, captured on video and played over and over for your children? In Canada, it was in 1972. We played a hockey series, Canada, against the Soviet Union. They were evil. We won. It was great. Paul Henderson's goal. I can almost like hear and recite back the play-by-play announcer. I watched that game sitting in an open concept classroom in Metcalf, Ontario, with about 50 other kids on one of those little TVs way up on, you know, on the little rolling stand. And when Henderson scored that goal, we went nuts. And it defined our generation. Unity. Online, we do pretty much the same thing. We have technologies that appeal to the mass and are used to create unity. All staff emails. How many of you gotten all staff emails? Who's just talking with Brandy before? She got an all staff text message that everybody got, 200 people or whatever, got the all staff. The corporate website, the portal, these are all things out of many one. Out of all these staff and employees in your company or your university or whatever, we're going to have this website. And this website will speak for all of us. Networks are almost defined by their opposite, defined by their diversity. A network thrives on diversity. It wouldn't be a network without diversity. To each his own, so goes the saying. And I know it's not gender neutral, but it's a very old saying. So I was faced with a choice. Do I quote the quote accurately or do I put it gender neutral? So I thought I'd quote the quote accurately and then apologize for 30 seconds. Interestingly, when I grew up, and again, I grew up in Metcalf, Ontario, small farm town, South Ottawa, population 500. We were feral. We roamed the fields and the forests, and if there were deer, we would have chased deer, but there were cows, so we chased cows. And our teachers would teach to us that Canada was different from the United States. And much later on, I realized, oh, that is Canadian identity. And the United States, like groups, constitutes a melting pot. In Canada, we were all taught, is a solid bowl, where each entity, the lettuce, the tomato, the whatever, cucumber, I don't know what you put in salads. That's what we put in salads. All of these things maintain their distinctness and their identity. And by maintaining their distinctness and identity, they create a whole that is something distinct and different from any individual entity. And indeed, something that cannot be created without maintaining that distinctness and identity. And the more I thought about this, I struggle with myself all the time, and I wonder, was it indoctrination or were they right? And after many years, I've come to the conclusion they were right. And so there is this idea of the network. There is this idea of distinctness and diversity in an environment where people are encouraged not to be the same, but to be different. And I like to think I have fulfilled my teacher's expectations. The encouragement not to consume and to absorb the message from the mass media, but to create, to be that media, to be the artist, to be the writer, to be the videographer. Canada routinely wins awards for its documentaries. We are the nation of documentary makers. I made a documentary recently. Why? Because, well, I'm Canadian, I had to. It's in the contract. Network technology that includes diversity, encourages diversity. Talking. Talking is one-to-one. Talking is not a mass phenomenon. Telephoning. Proper telephoning. This mobile stuff. No, I'm just kidding. But I've never been good with mobile phones. I hate this. I'm already an old fuddy-duddy. I'm not even retired. Anyhow. Writing letters. Personal emails. You see what characterizes these things, right? They're not one-to-many, they're one-to-one. And sometimes in the internet age, they're also many-to-many. But the idea here is that what defines these things is the set of connections between the individuals and not the content of what's going out. If you try to define what you mean by, say, telephoning or letter writing by the content of the messages, how would you do that? They're all in language. Well, they're not even all in language. You know, especially not with, you know, sending pictures and things like that. Internet technology that encourages diversity rather than conformity includes things like personal homepages, or these days blogs. I should add to this slide MySpace profiles and things like that. Your account on Flickr. All of these things that allows the individual to express themselves rather than the individual being part of some larger entity. It's funny, I have an email address. Surprise! My email address is stephen@downs.ca. And I'm just curious. Now, almost all of you will have email addresses. How many of you have an email address based on your institution, college, universities, or whatever address? In other words, you know, fred@somepolytechnic.edu.nz or whatever. Right. Where's your personal identity? Why the email? This is your email address. Right? And yet, your email address is your institutional address. How did that come to be? Imagine if your personal mail address, you know, the mail that you get from your grandmother, came through your employer and had to be sent to your employer before it got to you. It just seems odd. Groups require coordination. They require a leader, which is why we get all of this stuff on leadership. It's the funniest thing, all these things on leadership, because I read these and it's like everybody needs to be a leader, but my experience of groups is usually one leader and a bunch of followers. And, you know, I want to see the new business book that says everyone should be a follower. But, you know, I always look at these things from the point of view of the follower. People think about groups and leadership and direction and responsibility, and they usually mean my leadership, my direction, responsibility to me. And I look at groups differently because They don't let me lead groups. I don't understand why. I look at groups as, you know, somebody else's leadership, somebody else I'm responsible to. I have to follow their vision. It's being subsumed under somebody, you know, and people picture groups, but they don't picture them in terms of their actual role in the group. They picture them in terms of the role they would like to play in the group. It's a philosophy of aspiration rather than a philosophy of reality. Something that socialists need to look at, because socialists appeal to groups, right? They appeal to the worker, but nobody wants to be a worker. That's why socialists, at least in my country, get like 16-20% of the vote. You know, I'm surprised 16-20% of the people identify, yeah, I'm a worker. And, but, you know, people don't want to be a worker. They want to be a manager or retired, one or the other. Socialists speak to neither of those. A group is defined by its values. I said yesterday, and I say it again today, the person who came up with the concept of the vision statement should be thrown out the window. Because, think about it. You're in some institution. The powers that be from on high come down with the vision statement. You read the vision statement. How many of you go, yeah, that's my purpose in life? And what follows is a long, protracted exercise to get you to replace whatever vision you had with the vision of the group. And it seems odd. Groups define standards. Groups define belonging. In learning technology, most of learning technology is intended to support this picture. The learning management system. It's like managing learning. If you think about that, think about what that says, to manage learning. What does that mean? It means there will be a manager of learning. It means that there will be one person responsible for the learning, and everybody else will follow that. Learning design, where the learning is organized, sliced, diced, flaked, and formed, and you follow in a row, or you're not a learner. You're an anarchist. Learning object metadata, the 87 or whatever fields to describe a learning object being something that can be assembled like a Lego, like individual entities in a group. And this is the one and only way to describe learning resources. And if it's not in learning object metadata, it doesn't exist. Networks, by contrast, require autonomy. That is to say, each individual in a network operates independently. That does not mean operates alone. What that does, because remember, it's a network. You're connected. You talk to people. They talk to you. But it means you define your vision. It means you define what's going to be important to you, your values and interests. It means that when you go to work, the reason why you're at work is because you want to put food on your table, not the boss's table. The boss getting food on his or her table, that's just an accident. But that's not why you're there. It's interaction in a network isn't about leaders and followers. It's about, as I say here, a mutual exchange of value. And my employers don't like me that much because that's how I view myself as an employee. And I go into there and they say, well, we're going to give you these orders now. And I say, well, what are you going to give me for doing that? And they say, well, we pay you. I said, well, you paid me before. we already had an agreement. And now you're changing the agreement. And that's fine, you can change the agreement. But now I want some changes too. And so, well, I said, no, it doesn't work that way. If this is a mutual exchange of value, you can't just change the condition. I hear so many people say all the time, it was even in my email this morning, there was stuff about networks and that, and people say, oh, but we're in this institutional environment, we have to do what we're told. And my response is, who said so? I mean, why? I mean, the worst thing they could do is fire you and then you'd be free, but if you belong to a union, another group, right, you can actually set one group against the other and not follow their orders and still manage to be able to eat and house yourself. And it's a fascinating, when you reframe these things, you need to reframe these things. Think about the arrangement that they have set up for you. You will do what they say, or you will be forced to be homeless and starve. What kind of bargain is that? Right? So we have to do what we do, or they won't pay us. And the only people who can change that arrangement is you. And your bosses aren't going to change it, trust me. People don't follow, they don't do what they're told in a network. They interact, they make their own decisions, not completely independently, all on their own, all by their own, so they interact with other people, but they make their own decisions. It's like traveling from Auckland to Wellington, right? There are different ways you can do it. I mean, you can travel with a tour group, or you can take the bus, right? Taking the bus doesn't mean that you're traveling alone. It just means you're not traveling with a group, but you still interact, but your interaction is different. Now it's a mutual exchange between you and the bus driver, or you and the bus company, and I give them money, and they say, yes, we will take you to Wellington, and we won't leave you in the desert. And I say, good, because it's a nice desert, but I don't want to be left there. Now you think about the technology now that encourages autonomy rather than conformance. E-portfolios is being touted as this sort of technology. Personal learning environments, and you might not know what that is yet because they're new, but if you look that up on Google, you'll find stuff on personal learning environments. And that's the autonomous answer, the network answer to the learning management system. And it's based on a radical concept. Students can learn autonomously. Who would have believed? But if you read and listen to all this pedagogical theory, it's like, gee, if you don't take them by the hand and lead them through this, they'll be hopelessly lost and they'll never learn anything at all. And if that were true, the internet never would have been built. Because there were no classes on how to build an internet before it was built. How did they learn? Well, they learned on their own, self-directed. Groups are closed. This is the walls part of it. They require a boundary that distinguishes between members and non-members. Otherwise, it wouldn't be a group, right? They'd be just, well, not even a mob. Because a mob at least has a border. That's how they know which ones to arrest. Never mind. groups have memberships. Membership has its privileges. They have logins and passwords and authentication and blood type tests. They have controlled vocabularies, the standards, jargon. They have lock-in. You will use this technology. I'm a Mac person. I'm a PC person. Staying on message. He's a loose cannon. He's not part of the group. We speak as one. With one voice we speak. That's what a group is. A group defines itself with very precise limits. Look at the limits. Look at the boundaries. Look at the walls that you have in your learning environment today, your learning technology environment, but even your learning environment today. Look at the walls here. Right? We've managed to keep all the other people out. Right? And if somebody who was just walking on the street tried to come in here, sit down and listen, we would stop them. Think about that. That's our theory of learning. If somebody wants to come in and listen, we stop them. Enterprise computing, federated search is a system whereby you search only accepted resources that have been approved, qualified, and typically are commercial and for sale. User IDs and passwords, copyrights, patents, you cannot use that shade of green, it's owned by BP. You cannot use the word Coca-Cola, not even to talk about Coca-Cola, because we own that. I'm Tim O'Reilly. I invented the concept Web 2.0. You can have a conference, but you cannot call it Web 2.0. I'm Blackboard. I invented the learning management system. We will put a wall around anyone else trying to do it. And even whether or not it's true or not true doesn't matter. You build the wall, and it becomes true. Assertions of exclusivity define groups. Networks are the opposite of that. Networks are open. Networks require that all entities in the network be able to both send and receive. First of all, in their own way, because they're diverse, right? And secondly, without being impeded. Now, Oddly, that is a radical concept. Hard to believe that something like freedom of speech is a radical concept, but there it is. In their own way, a person in a network should be able to send their message any way they want, in their own language, using their own computer encoding, using their Macintosh computer. I don't know why they want to, but they can. Sorry, I'm not a Mac person. I'm a PC. Can you see the top? Platform independence, using standards that are non-standards. I talk from time to time about RSS. RSS, sometimes people talk about RSS in the same breath they talk about learning object metadata, because they're both types of XML. But if you look at the history of RSS, it's a mess. There is no such thing as RSS, or no individual thing as RSS. There's 8 or 9 or 10 or what, we don't even know how many different types of RSS. And some types of RSS aren't even called RSS. And yet it works. There are many, many hundreds of times more RSS feeds than there are learning object metadata feeds. In fact, I don't know if there are any learning object metadata feeds. Communities of practice, where community is defined as collections of individuals that exchange messages and ideas back and forth without being impeded. Copyright, trademarks, proprietary software, all of these things are barriers to the communication of thoughts and ideas. They are, if you allow that using content, images, text, video is a way of speaking to each other, then copyright, trademark, all these things are ways of locking down our speech, saying, I own the word such and such, and you can't use it. Imagine I invented radar, and I decided, I am going to own the word radar from now on, and anybody who talks about radar has to get my approval before they can use that word. Can you imagine how communication works in an environment where you have to get permission in order to use a word as simple as radar? But that's what's happening now with all of this copyright stuff. The network approach to this stuff is to open this up. Creative Commons, GPL. The network response to a meeting like this with four walls, a ceiling, and happily a floor is this. The iRiver, in this case, which is recording this talk in MP3. After this talk, sometime, I'm not sure exactly when, because of bandwidth issues, I'm going to do a radical act. I'm going to take the talk that I just gave, I'm going to put it on the internet, and anyone can listen to it. And they won't even have to pay me. And even better, they can take this talk, they can put it on their own computer system, they can print it out on a CD and pass it around their village in Lesotho or whatever, they won't have to pay. And if they think I've gone on too long, a lot of people think that, they can chop it up and just do little snippets, like, a lot of people think that, and, you know, you hit a button, a lot of people think that. And they can mix and mash, and I want them to do this because I want part of my words, my thoughts, my thinking, my ideas to become part of the culture, part of the language, part of the dialogue. And it strikes me as, and the only way to do that is to no longer own it. The only way a word becomes a word is if you let go of it. Groups are distributive. Money, information, power, everything flows from the center, an authority. And it's distributed through the members. Oops. Oh, okay. I wonder where it went. Right, let's go forward. Okay, well, there's a slide there, you just have to imagine it. I'm sure it existed. Oh, that's backwards, dang. I'm sorry, I keep getting confused by forward and backward here, and I really should turn this. It's funny, you know, you have these expectations, and they're confounded. And like, whoever designed the mouse, and I guess it was someone from Xerox ages ago, what were they thinking? I guess they thought nobody will ever use this. Okay. Yeah. I should belong to the group of people that read and think from left to right. And then this makes perfect sense. Forward is that way. Backwards is that way. Yeah. Networks are distributed. In a network, there is no locus of knowledge. There is no place that knowledge and money and all of that flow from. Rather, the knowledge, the money, the information, anything that is exchanged in a network is distributed across the entities of a network. When an idea propagates through a network, it does not come from a centralized source. Rather, it comes from any given source in the network, and then through a process of what they call propagation, it works its way through the network. Think about diseases. Yes, I came here and talked about diseases. There's no central disease authority where we get all of our diseases from. Happily. Some say the CIA, but that would be the group way of doing it. Diseases spring up anywhere. The flu comes from Hong Kong. Ebola comes from Ebola. They can spring up anywhere, and then what happens is they propagate person to person, contact to contact. And there's a very specific logic of how diseases propagate from person to person, contact to contact. It's this whole social networking graph theory. And the mathematics of that is actually very simple. If the probability that the disease will be passed on is greater than one, the disease will spread through the society. If the probability is less than one, it will be halted at some point. And then you work around the mechanics of all of that. So the network works that way. The network works where the idea, the money, the resource, whatever, may happen to be anywhere, and then it propagates link by link through the entire network. And then each entity working on its own will have a specific probability of passing this on. And if collectively the probabilities are on average greater than one, then the idea or the concept will become common throughout the network and not otherwise. And in practice, what you'll find is some parts of the network are such that the idea has been accepted there, but for one reason or another, it didn't quite make it to the rest of the network. And so you get variety within the network itself. There's been a lot of talk, and sort of this is in the back of my mind when I'm saying that last sentence, which is why that last sentence was a little confused. There's a lot of talk these days about something called a power law. In networks. And what a power law is a way of explaining the distribution of links in a network. And it looks like this. So it's sort of a curve, right? And the idea is that some sites, like Google site, have many, many links in from other people. Lots of people link to Google. And then you get other sites, like my site, you know, a few thousand people, and then other sites, dozen people, and then many, many, many other sites, you know, just two or three people. So you have, and they call that the long tail, right? So the long tail, this is where the new economy is and all of that, is the long tail, and all of these individuals with just two or three links. But the thing is, you know, this message is being given to us mostly by people who are in what I call the big spike, the A-listers, and they're sitting there saying, look at this power law, we're up here. We're making a mint. But is that 11, 11:30, or 11:24? Okay. So I shouldn't have gone on this digression, I guess. Oops. The thing is, that power law distribution is more characteristic of groups than it is of networks. And a network properly constructed will not see that configuration where, you know, 2% of all the people own 80% of all the wealth or all the links or all the whatever. And it rather becomes more distributed. The more evenly you distribute your links, the more evenly you distribute your wealth. Why networks? Three major reasons. First of all, the nature of the knower. Human beings resemble ecosystems more than they resemble lumps of metal. Okay, that's a bad way of putting it, but you know what I mean. And I only have like 30 seconds left. Secondly, and very importantly, the quality of the knowledge. Groups, because the knowledge comes from the authority, from the center, even if there's consultation and all of that, the knowledge of groups is limited by the capacity of the leader to know things. which is why dictatorships are so bad, because dictators, as smart as they are, and some of them are very smart, just simply aren't capable of running an entire country by themselves. Nobody can do it. It takes too much knowing. And then finally, the nature of the knowledge itself. The knowledge in a group replicates the knowledge in the individuals. And it's passed on simple in a transmission, communication kind of way. Those of you who are into learning theory, think more, transaction theory, all of that. Communication theory. It goes from here to here to here to here. And consequently, that limits the type of knowledge that can be created and communicated. And I've characterized it here a bit badly as simple, cause-effect, yes-no sorts of things. The sorts of knowledge you can get when looking at mass phenomena, the sorts of knowledge that you can get by polls and things like that. But in a network, the knowledge is emergent. The knowledge is not in any given individual, but it's a property of the network as a whole. Consequently, it's a knowledge that cannot, does not exist in any individual, but only in the network as a whole. It's emergent, it's more complex, in the sense that it is able to capture and describe phenomena that are not simple, like cause-effect, but complex, like the nature of societies or the nature of the weather. That's a very loose characterization of that. I can go on for another hour about that, but she won't let me. And so I'll thank you for your time. I really appreciate the invitation, and I thank you so much for the opportunity to be here to speak to you. It's been a tremendous honor.
So on behalf of the EFIRST Network, thank you very much, Stephen. We really appreciate your words. You've moved us along. I really hope you've been challenged. I hope your thoughts and thinkings about learning have been challenged as much as mine. And I've got a new thinking on WWW. I don't think it means the World Wide Web. I think it means the world without walls. So thanks for introducing that to my
program.
Okay.
And I've always wanted a red patch.
Actually, now I can individualize my backpack.
Okay, so we've got our next breakout sessions, everybody, and hopefully you'll find those very